The National Broadcasting Company and its affiliated independent stations present The Words We Live By, the summer series of the Eternal Light program, which comes to you under the auspices of the Jewish Theological Seminary of America. Today we present the 13th in this series of 15 literary dialogues on democracy and the Bible, featuring two of America's foremost men of letters, Maurice Samuel and Mark Van Doren.
Mark, the subject we have before us today is the sinister one of war. War in relation to democratic thought and to the general philosophy of the Bible. But as usual, I've got a hangover from some of our previous discussions. I can't let some of the ideas go.
I know, they are so rich.
Well, they have a relevance, actually, to the subject before us, also to the subject that we've dealt with in the past weeks. We were talking about education and about government, the relationship between the two. And you had raised the very tragic subject of government control of thought, conditioning yes. of the people. It occurred to me there's a subtle way in which that sort of pressure is exercised, not with the immediate intent of putting across an idea, as we would say, but of flattering people into thinking that they are individually in control of a situation. You know those posters during election time when a finger points at you and under it are the startling words, "You can change the course of history."
Yes.
Well, of course, this is rubbish. No individual can change the course of history. There's a flattery there of the individual, which is, whether intended or not, is productive of a mob feeling. A man goes around patting himself on the chest, "Now my vote has this and this importance." Whereas the importance of the vote is really a moral one. You are obligated morally to participate in the government of the country, but not under the delusion that what you have to say is the determining factor in your capacity as an individual.
Excuse me, Maurice. There is a point, however, there where the thing becomes subtle. It also is true that in a democracy which deserves the name, every citizen must have the faith that might make a great deal of difference what he thought and said. Don't you think that must be true? Because if each individual thinks it makes no difference what he thinks and says, nobody will think or speak.
Well, let me put it to you this way. I know that my individual vote makes very, very little difference, but it does not militate against my voting. I feel it is my duty to do so. In case there's a chance, 1 in 10 million, that it has some influence. Now, that's a pretty slim chance on which to go. But that isn't the point for me. The point is that I have to register my point of view and to have it counted there without any illusion as to the overwhelming importance of my participation.
Yes, but you must have no illusion that your vote does not have a great importance for you. It must have been the wisest vote you were capable of casting.
Oh, it implies having thought it out, discussed it, and come to a conclusion. I'll tell you what it reminds me of. Lytton Strachey wrote a book once on government and power. I don't remember the exact title. In which he uses a curious argument. He said, if you are on a boat you begin to bore a hole at the bottom of the seat and you say, it's nobody's business, only where I am, I'm the only person who's going to get wet. You forget that this is going to have its influence on the entire boat. If one of these false arguments, I might say phony arguments, the amount of hole that I can bore in a boat which carries 10 million or 100 million people is not going to influence the outcome. It is immoral to bore that hole in the boat independently of what happens to the rest of the boat.
Yes.
This is what I'm trying to express in relation to education and responsibility and government, especially now coming into the subject of today. The question of war, a man votes. He votes credits, or he votes for the war, or he expresses his approval. He must not do so under the impression that he is deciding history. He must do so under the impression that he is doing the moral thing. This is the relationship between morality and government. It is a parallel to the argument, again, Lytton straightly implies this, be moral or society will collapse. Now, my being moral or immoral will have very little influence on society, but it is of fateful importance to me whether I am moral or immoral. And this is a subtle form of, I would almost call it demagoguery, in appealing to people to vote.
Yeah, I see your point. What you're doing is placing something higher than society, aren't you?
We're coming back indeed to the one of the basic themes that we've been discussing this summer. But to get into the subject itself, I would start the discussion with the blank statement that war is the fundamental enemy of democracy.
Yes.
As it is indeed the enemy of morality. Would you agree to that statement as a general blanket statement?
I certainly would. And if it was never clearly true before, it is true now. I think it was always clearly true, but it is surely true now. I heard a statement the other day that with the weapons now at our command, there's no longer any sense in talking about a just war. War can never be just.
Well, who was it? Was it Franklin that said there never was a good war or a bad peace?
Who said this?
I think it was Benjamin Franklin.
Yes, I think
I'm not,
so.
I'm not sure. It was felt before, but let me say that we are almost taking it for granted that this is seen by most people, but I don't think that it is. Let me go back to a very early statement which has been very frequently quoted. Heraclitus has the statement, war is both king of all and father of all, and it has revealed some as gods, others as men, some it has made slaves, others free. War is both king of all and father of all. It produces everything that human beings value or human beings fear, and it is the determinant of the status of human beings, whether they are slaves or whether they are free men. They cannot conceive types of this mind. I don't know whether it was a consistent view with Heraclitus. We have only fragments of his philosophy.
Well, I would guess, Maurice, that he was not meaning war in the total sense in which we now mean it, or even in the military sense in which we now mean it. I think he meant, as some of his other fragments suggest, strife, conflict, even argument. And maybe there is something to be said for this argument against war. Argument against war as we now know it. Maybe the chief argument is that it stops all the little wars that are part of life. Argument, competition, athletic competition, if nothing else. But argument among men. You know, sometimes in our situations of total war, as they now develop, men cannot argue with one another because it's unsafe. It's considered by the state unsafe that they should express their opinion. Life is made up of little wars, and I use wars there only in the sense of conflict.
Strife.
A play in the theater must have conflict. We all know that. There must be forces opposed to each other. And men love to argue. Men love to convince one another if they can. And the people compete quite with one another, quite genuinely and quite honorably, it seems to me, for high posts and for fame and so forth.
Perhaps we ought to say that the word war, we say nowadays that war has become obsolete. Perhaps the word has become obsolete. It no longer means what it used to mean.
That's right.
If war at one time meant strife in which finally there is an accommodation, a brutal accommodation, undemocratic, unethical, but still an accommodation, then war is no longer an operable word.
That's right.
But even in that field to which you have momentarily restricted the application of the word, I find painful reminders everywhere of men who looked upon war in its earlier and let me say a more tolerable sense as a good thing. Imagine a man like Emerson saying this. War educates the senses, calls into action the will, perfects the physical constitution, brings men into swift and close collision in critical moments when man measures man. Well, to me, that's horrible.
Yes.
How did a man like Emerson come to say a thing like that?
It is strange. You know, there is a difference, of course, that I want to remind you of between the little dynastic wars in which just a few soldiers, possibly mercenary or professional at any rate, marched up and down with red coats and brilliant gold braid and all that sort of thing, and decided successions to thrones and that sort of thing without bothering most of the people. Maybe in the long run the people were advantaged or disadvantaged by this. I dare say both. There is a difference between that kind of war, which I don't like to contemplate either, and the kind of war that now faces us as a possibility. A war which, as you say, almost obliterates the term itself, just as it may obliterate all living.
You know, Mark, let me interpolate something.
I mean, I think it's very important
to
say that one of these
dubious advantages that one speaks of in war having become impossible is illuminated for me from a certain point of view that is seldom discussed. We say that war is becoming impossible because it's going to mean the obliteration of all populations, maybe the obliteration of civilization, and that therefore it won't take place. There is, in my mind, a perhaps more cogent reason why war won't take place, because for the first time in history, war will obliterate the politicians.
Yes.
They will wake up the next morning with no one to get the vote from, to administer.
Well, if they wake up.
if they wake up at all. So that this perhaps is a bigger deterrent than the calamitous prospects of populational obliteration.
Well, now, Maurice, you bring up all sorts of fascinating things here. I have two in mind at the moment. Even during the last World War, World War II, so-called, from 1939 to 45, apparently there were lots of persons in our own democracy who then believed that they were more alive than they'd ever been before or they would ever be again. And I've heard some of them say since, that was the time. I was in the Pacific, I was in Germany, I was in France. What a time I had, how interesting life was. I had a relation with my fellow men that was clear and strong and simple. Now I'm just going through this dull routine of my life. I'm doing a job, but it isn't as interesting as that was. I know a man older than that whose only memories, apparently, are of World War I. He was in France, and he was a colonel, and he bored everybody to death, as a matter of fact, by talking of nothing but that.
What a terrible reflection that is on our civilization.
Yes, it's dreadful.
And the condition of these men whose lives are so, I must say, are so paltry that they must have recourse, as it were, to a drug, to a deadly drug.
Well, you see,
and
the
memory of it is the one thing that they cherish in their lives.
Yes, the problem is to convince people that peace is more interesting than war. I happen to think it is.
It is, but it has to be made interesting.
Yes, but really more interesting and more exciting. With all the little wars, as I say, I keep using that phrase, partly because I wrote a poem once with that title. I can't remember it now. I won't endeavor to say it. But all the little wars stop when the great war, as a sort of a monster, a tyrant...
And the great war, certainly, if we use the word war for it, will not be interesting for anybody. Nobody of the survivors is going to look back and say, oh, what a glorious time I had surviving in my shelter, if he survived.
By the way, there are wars in the Bible, you know. What are we going to say about that?
I've got a lot to say about it. In fact, I'll be wanting to continue this series into the winter to tell you what I have, and I'm certain you have many ideas too. But you mentioned just now the First World War, in which I was a soldier, not a terribly active one. I never got further than the advance zone in France. I was in the American Army, and then I was yanked out and put to what was called intelligence. Without having been tested at all for my capabilities in that field. I've been reading lately that very excellent book, that remarkable book, The Guns of August. I don't know if you've...
No, I haven't read it, but I intend to.
It's a very remarkable book. There I came across a bitter disappointment. You know what a high regard I have for Thomas Mann.
Yes.
You have too.
Yes.
We've talked about him at length in one of our summer colloquies. And there, for the first time, I came across statements he had made in the First World War, and they were very ghastly to me. I copied them out to use in these talks. He saw in war, and here comes the quote, a purification, a liberation, an enormous hope. The victory of Germany, he said, will be a victory of soul over numbers. Then he went on. In another passage, the German soul is opposed to the pacifist ideal of civilization, for is not peace an element of civil corruption? It's a dreadful thing. For yes. It changed his... But he was a grown man when he said this. He had already written excellent books. I think he had by that time written Buddenbrook, certainly.
Yes, I think so. He wrote that very early.
Yes, and perhaps... Yes, or... No, The Magic Mountain he wrote afterwards, because in it he tells of the hero going off to the First World War. But it frightens me that you should find a man of this caliber already in his mature years. He was in the 40s, I think. Having this view with regard to war.
Well, Maurice, that is a dreadful statement, as Emerson's was, and as many statements that you could dredge up out of the German philosophers and militarists of the 19th century. They loved war.
Yes, the Heinrich von Treitschke is one of the famous, he may very well be called a warmonger. God will see to it that war always recurs as a drastic medicine for the human race. Well, if the human race needs periodic administrations of this kind of medicine, it's not worth keeping at all. If our virtues cannot flourish without regular outbursts of bloodthirst and of killing. Or Friedrich von Bernardi, another of them. War is a biological necessity of the first importance, a regulative element in the life of mankind which cannot be dispensed with. But it is not only a biological necessity, but a moral obligation, and as such, an indispensable factor in civilization. In other words, if we hadn't discovered the atomic bomb, and I suppose even from Bernardi, I don't know whether he would say even the atomic bomb is a good thing. Mm. Is that conceivable, or von Treitschke say, yes, let three-quarters of the race or half of the human race be wiped out and the rest exposed to all sorts of biological abominations? It's good for us. But, I don't think... I think at this point they too would collapse.
I'm sure this is just as dead as... All these words are as dead as words can be.
Still, Mark, we still talk of holding off the atomic war, but meanwhile we're going to have these little wars, and people will say, well, these little wars, these limited wars are pretty good. It does all of these things.
By the way, you understand, when I was talking about little wars a while ago, I didn't mean limited wars. I didn't mean wars at all. I meant the little strifes, the little competitions.
You're talking of the competitive attitude in human beings.
No, the thing that makes people alive in peace.
Wars
of peace, I
yes.
I didn't mean limited wars.
I certainly misunderstood you.
Oh, no, I mean the little wars of peace, the thing that makes life interesting all the time.
The war is so horrible that I didn't recognize it in that country.
Oh, well, I'm very glad to have been able to make that clear. Now, you know, there's another thing that I know you're familiar with. Another point, which is no longer, I think, a point of any great importance. You remember in the two world wars in which the United States has been engaged... the problem was to persuade the people of this democracy to wage a war at all. Because, after all, democracy and war are, I think, opposed at their very heart. Whereas the German government was ready at a moment's notice to mobilize its people, and its people were easily mobilized, yet it was difficult for us. To begin that war. And the statement was often made, a democracy is bound to be very slow and inefficient and sluggish and even slovenly about starting. It will make many waste motions, but once it is aroused, once all the people are aroused and thoroughly understand that they should fight, they will fight as the subjects.
That's a subject. Now you mention it.
Of a despot never will.
Yes, you mention it.
But all that has gone by too.
Well, let me. It's gone by, but there's a lesson to be learned from it. Many people speak of a preventive war or a preemptive war, or they speak of the best defense is an offensive. It's one of those glib catchwords that has got by very easily. I'm inclined sometimes to suggest that the best offensive is a defensive in this sense. That when a man is reluctant to fight, when he is finally aroused to it, he's going to be much more dangerous than the man who is trigger happy and is ready to fight. And there are important instances, besides the one you've mentioned, how reluctant America was. You remember Wilson's statement, which has been so cruelly caricatured and derided. There is such a thing as being too proud to fight.
Yes.
It was a very noble statement.
Yes, it was.
But I want to give you an instance from Jewish history. You remember we talked of the Sabbath and we reverted to the fact that the Sabbath was held so holy by certain sections of Jews that they wouldn't fight on the Sabbath. And indeed, in the code of Maimonides, who has taken the whole of the law and codified it sectionally so that it's manageable, he says that if it's a war in which the only thing you are threatened with is not murder, but the payment of taxes, you mustn't fight on the Sabbath. Mm. Very curious application there, a specific application. But the wars of the Maccabees, when you study them very carefully in the first two books of the Maccabees, are a very interesting illustration of the best offensive is a defensive. The Jews did not want to fight. When old Mattathias, the father of the Maccabean clan, the progenitor of the Hasmonean kings, finally roused them, it was after long, long patient refusal to take up arms. And it was only when all the patience had been exhausted and all the reluctance to turn to the methods of war had been overcome that they became furious fighters. The army that was led by Judas Maccabeus and then by his brothers was composed of men largely pacifist by inclination and by long intellectual acclimatation. But you see what happened afterwards. The Maccabeans became the Hasmonean kings, who became conquistadors.
Yes.
And interestingly,
became lovers of war.
Became lovers of war, they became conquistadors, and they were disliked. And in the Jewish tradition, they are made very little of. It's only recently that they've been brought to the forefront, a feature which has its dubious aspects. But we're going to talk more in our next week's session about war in the Bible. The one thing I do want to bring to the fore now is that in the Bible there is no glorification of war. We're going to find a lot of mitigation of war. But there
we're
is
going
no
to find plenty of wars, too.
Plenty of wars, but no glorification of war except by a horse.
Mm-hmm. Or the horse in Job?
The horse, that's right, in Job.
Yeah.
We find in Job, he saith among the trumpets, ha ha, and he smelleth the battle afar off, the thunder of the captains and the shouting. That's the horse talking.
The old war horse.
Well, the horse. But no human being among the Jews talks of war in that excited and anticipatory tone that he's going to have a marvelous time. This is essentially the attitude of the Bible toward war as toward slavery.
Yes.
Found slavery, and it set about the mitigation of slavery with the dream of its expunging it from human relations.
Well, of course, we mustn't forget the prophets who look forward to a time when we shall learn war no more.
Yes.
After all, they're most beautiful.
I won't let that pass so easily. We'll learn war no more. Do you know, that's the phrase that most people miss. They put up on the United Nations building, and they shall beat their swords into plowshares,
okay.
And their... I remember the Hebrew... their spears into pruning hooks.
Yes.
A nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn any more war. Do you realize... I'm sure you do. I'm saying it rhetorically. What that means... They shall not learn any more war. In the old days, they had to learn war. There was plenty of learning. There was strategy. There were tricks. We find the strategic dodges that were used in the wars, and which the Israelis have been using lately, you know.
Yes.
By going back to Joshua and Judges, they found roads and paths. War was studied. Men were trained in arms. They were trained as generals. Thousands of years ago, there was... strategic formation of groups, whether it would be into phalanxes or into the formation used, the square formation used by the Roman legions. They studied it. But what it means nowadays to learn war, it means everything.
Yes.
Neither shall they learn any more war means you've got to give up studying the atom and the biological warfare and psychological warfare and economic warfare, or these things in application to war.
And, of course, the day has passed when our democracy or any democracy can assume that it has any time, that it can be saved by an ally or something of that sort. So while it takes its time and prepares, there is not going to be any time at all. And that is, I think, what makes us all so serious suddenly. We should have been serious before. It makes us all so serious suddenly now about war. You remember we were talking the other day about how the Negroes of the United States in the 19th century seemed to know their Bible very well. One of their greatest songs was, "We're Going to Study War No More." Do you remember that?
Yes.
"We're going to study war no more."
Yes.
"We're going to study war no more." I don't know that any song that they sang moves me more than that. Now, all they were doing was paraphrasing, was just the change of one word. Was Isaiah's?
It's in Isaiah, yeah. And it's repeated in Micah. It must have been a folk passage. It occurs in the two prophets, almost word for word. "Neither shall they learn any more war." The relief that I sometimes envisage, we won't be told of war colleges and of staffs and of this is the way it's got to be carried out. We won't live under the shadow of this emotional, this nervous preoccupation with the murder of other human beings. It's something that... it's something that we certainly want to discuss again in next week's talk.
And it's behind the reluctance of the American people even now to take civil defense seriously, don't you think so?
Yes.
I think that's what it really means. They just will not learn war, because that is learning war.
You have just heard "The Words We Live By," the 13th in the 15-week Eternal Light summer series. Be with us again next week when Maurice Samuel and Mark Van Doren will resume their discussion of democracy and the Bible. "The Words We Live By" is produced under the auspices of the Jewish Theological Seminary of America. This pre-recorded program has been an NBC Public Affairs presentation. This is the NBC Radio Network.